Welcome to Echo Zoe Radio. I'm your host, Andy Olson, proprietor of EchoZoe.com. Thanks for joining me once again for another episode. This is number 17 for September 2009. For this episode, I have the pleasure of bringing you, my listeners, along with me for a small portion of a family vacation that I just returned from. My wife, son, and I spent 3 days in Chicago over Labor Day weekend before driving down to Cincinnati for a few days. While in the Cincinnati area, we toured the Creation Museum that is operated by Answers in Genesis, a Christian ministry that focuses on young earth creationism. I had the privilege and the pleasure, while at the Creation Museum, of sitting down to talk with a few of the staff members at Answers in Genesis. I spoke with Mark Loy, co-founder of AIG, Dr. Terry Mortensen, AIG's resident expert on geology, and Dr. Georgia Purdom, AIG's expert on molecular genetics. First, I sat down with Mark Loy. Mark is a co-founder of Answers in Genesis and their chief communications officer. He handles public relations and fundraising for AIG, as well as marketing. He also co-hosts and co-produces our daily radio feature called Answers with Ken Ham, which is heard on over 1,300 stations worldwide. In addition, Mark serves as the science and culture editor for AIG's Answers magazine and writes and edits their monthly newsletter. Mark got his start in the creation-evolution debate over 30 years ago and wrote for articles on the topic while working at the Institute for Creation Research. With the full blessing and a donation from ICR's founder, Dr. Henry Morris, Mark, along with his colleagues Ken Ham and Mike Zovath, left ICR to form Answers in Genesis in 1994. Welcome, Mark. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Andy, thank you, and thank you for coming here to the Creation Museum.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. My wife and I were just walking through the museum when you caught us and enjoying the exhibits. And
yeah, your son is what, about 2 years of age?
He'll be 2.5 in about a month, a couple weeks.
He probably liked the dinosaurs, didn't he?
Loves dinosaurs.
Well, we have animatronic dinosaurs here which move very, very realistically. And we intentionally put dinosaurs in our creation museum because we want to use dinosaurs to tell the true history of the world according to the Bible, whereas almost all science museums are evolutionary and use dinosaurs as their icon to promote evolution. So we use dinosaurs here in a very, very different way. Plus, frankly, it's a marketing tool. Kids want to come to the so-called dinosaur museum. Sometimes children don't even remember the name Creation Museum. They'll say, hey, Mom, hey, Dad, let's go to the dinosaur museum.
Yeah, well, you guys have done a fabulous job from what we've seen so far. And could you tell us a little bit about the museum and what your focus is? I mean, obviously it's creation, but specifically?
Yeah, first people should know that the Creation Museum is just one outreach of a ministry, an apologetics ministry called Answers in Genesis. We're about 15 years old as a ministry. We do teaching seminars all across the world. Ken Ham, as we record this, has just come back from a speaking engagement in Japan. We have one of the most popular Christian websites now in the world with huge traffic to answersingenesis.org. Ken Ham and I do a daily radio program. We produce a worldview magazine called Answers. So there's many things happening here, but the most recent outreach, if you will, is our Creation Museum, which opened up just over 2 years ago. We are sitting right now in northern Kentucky, but very close to Cincinnati, Ohio. We're within a day's drive of almost two-thirds of America's population. In other words, 190 million Americans can drive to the Creation Museum in about a day, about 600 miles or so. And God has blessed us with close to 900,000 visitors now in about 27 months, which has far exceeded our expectations.
That's amazing. And we caught you at a good time. You normally you're very busy in the summer. And
oh, yeah, we just came off of the summer and the Labor Day weekend where, you know, we could easily have 2,000 people here in a day. But as soon as school starts, the attendance drops, and you'll have several hundred people here today. But at the same time, that's it's nice for our visitors. They don't have to stand in line and sometimes wait for some of the performances to start.
Yeah, we're recording now on September 9th. It's 2 days after Labor Day. So we'll actually, a lot of the kids are back at school, and it's been a very nice experience walking through.
And we'll see an increase in attendance around Christmas time because we'll decorate our grounds. We're on 78 acres of land out here with a mile of nature trails. And I don't know if you and your son have gone to our petting zoo yet, but right across the lake here we have, you know, a kangaroo, a camel, some other exotic animals. But at Christmas time, We decorate this place very well, a live nativity scene. Everyone who comes at Christmas time gets a free video from us called The Last Adam, who is Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. because we want people who come here to visit not just to give up on evolution and not just to accept the fact that there's a creator, but accept the fact that Christ is our Savior. Mm-hmm. And so we are a very, very evangelistic facility, as I hope you've picked up on already.
Yeah, I have, and it's been a great experience. I was telling you before we set up that we're here with a friend of my wife's from Germany who's not a believer. And it's been great to walk through the museum and have the gospel is really presented very well as you progress through the museum.
Well, thank you. That's very intentional. You know, the museum, of course, we want Christians to come here and get answers to help defend their faith. Mm-hmm. You know, dinosaurs, why does God allow suffering and death? What about Cain's wife, carbon dating? We do present those answers for Christians, but more than anything, we want this to be an evangelistic place that you can take your unsaved family members and friends to and perhaps hear the gospel for the very first time. But we know that a lot of people won't even listen to the message of Christ because they think the Bible is unreliable, it's not accurate, and therefore the gospel message itself is maybe myth or allegory. But once people find out the book of Genesis is a straightforward a piece of literature, a straightforward history, we don't have to allegorize it or try to squeeze millions or billions of years into the Genesis text. And you answer questions about dinosaurs, carbon dating, Cain's wife. Once you answer those questions, people are more open to listening to the New Testament message of the gospel.
Mm-hmm. I've also very much appreciated the honesty. On the way down here from Minneapolis, we stopped in Chicago for a few days and walked through the Field Museum. And of course, they've got a very biased and focused view on origins of life. But here at the Creation Museum, you're very honest where you are drawing a line between what God says and what the evidence says, and then where you're speculating. For instance, I just walked through, I was by one of your animatronic dinosaurs when you caught me, and the display was talking about the transition from herbivores to carnivores. And it didn't flat out say this is why carnivores started eating meat. It says this is, we don't know why, and this is some of our theories. Whereas when you walk through a more of an evolutionist exhibit, they just use words like may have, could have, but they use it forcefully, like this is what the best of science will teach, and this is what we believe in. You should take this as fact.
Well, yeah, the Field Museum, and I last time I visited there was 3 years ago as they opened up their new Darwin exhibit. Mm-hmm. It teaches evolution, preaches evolution with a great degree of dogmatism. The other thing that people are surprised about the Creation Museum, too, is we present the evolutionary belief system mm-hmm. and the so-called evidence that supports evolution. So we don't run away from Lucy, the so-called mm-hmm. you know, transitional form. We present what the evolutionists believe, but then we refute it. Mm-hmm. And so we are certainly an advocacy ministry. We want to tell people creation is true, the Bible is true. But at the same time, I think even the evolutionist who goes through here will admit that we present evolution in a fair way. We don't twist things, but we just present a different interpretation of the facts. And one of the first rooms of the Creation Museum is called the Starting Points Room, where we argue there that creationists and evolutionists have the same evidence. We rarely mm-hmm. disagree with them over the evidence. It's the interpretation of the evidence that creates that divergence. And I have a bias, and my bias influences how I look at the evidence. But at the same time, I'm a former evolutionist. I used to accept that Neanderthal man was halfway between a modern human and an ape-like ancestor until I put on my critical thinking glasses, if you will, and looked at the evidence from a different perspective and found out that Neanderthal man really wasn't a missing link at all. He was just a modern human from centuries back who was slouched over, not because he was ape-like in characteristics, but he had a bone disease, and so he wasn't on the way up. Being upright, he was on the way down. And so I think a lot of the evolutionists who come and tour the museum, even they are starting to admit, yeah, your preconceived bias or your worldview is going to cloud or color how you look at the evidence. But again, creationists and evolutionists rarely disagree over the evidence itself. It's how it's interpreted.
And very well presented, too. I like how you walk in and you'll have on the left side, this is what you probably were taught in school, and this is how we look at the same evidence through biblical eyes.
Thank you. That's one of the main points in the museum, that all of us, and my bias now is to believe in the Bible, whereas, you know, 40 years ago, my bias was to accept the views of fallible secular scientists to believe in evolution. So I used to believe in the evolutionary worldview of millions of years until I took a hard look at the evidence and saw there's a better interpretation. Mm-hmm. And so Ken Ham and I have been in the creation movement now for about, going on 30 years.
And I noticed in your bio and your media information, you started off actually with ICR.
Yeah, Ken Ham and I for several years worked with our friends in San Diego. They're now in Texas, called the Institute for Creation Research. Mm-hmm. That's the research organization that was founded by Henry Morris, and then Duane Gish came a little bit later. And so they're the leading creationist think tank in the United States. Mm-hmm. And Ken and I left 15 years ago from the ministry there with the blessing of Henry Morris to start a more layman's ministry. See, ICR has a graduate school. It conducts a lot of research, whereas we saw a big need for a layman's ministry to get into the church and equip families with answers. Now, we do have academic research going on here. We have several people who have doctorate degrees, but we are not first and foremost a research think tank, which ICR is. Mm-hmm. But we have, in fact, you'll be interviewing a couple of people here soon who have doctorates in their fields. One person, I'm sorry you're missing today because he's on vacation, has a PhD in astronomy. And we have another fellow on board who has a PhD in biology from Brown University, which is an Ivy League school, and a PhD in geology, and I could go on and on. But mm-hmm. there are many qualified scientists working here at the Creation Museum.
Well, that's great. It's also great to hear that there's a venue for that kind of research. You know, after I'm sure you probably saw Expelled, Ben Stein's movie.
Yeah, we're actually in the movie very briefly because the movie was produced before we opened the Creation Museum. But there's one scene of protesters mm-hmm. holding up signs against creationists. Those were the protesters who were outside the gates of our ministry about 2.5 years ago. So we are in there, though, just in a fleeting reference. But yes, there are many documented instances, many more than the film even, mm-hmm. recounted of people who have either been fired or demoted or been harassed because they even question evolution. There's one fellow in the beginning part of the movie by the name of Dr. Sternberg who's an avowed evolutionist, but the very fact that he would allow an article in a publication to appear that appeared to support intelligent design and go against evolution was enough for him to lose his research position. And that was an evolutionist who was expelled, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so we're discovering there are a number of professors around the United States who are teaching at the university level. They have their PhDs, but because they're concerned about their position, they're not saying that they're creationists or evolution doubters until they get tenure, and then you can be a little bit more bold in what you say. Mm-hmm. The museum, Andy, is pretty much a walk through history, according to the Bible, mm-hmm. from its first book, Genesis, to the book of Revelation. We want to show our visitors that the Bible is true and accurate, and it's a historical document. Many people like to look at the book of Genesis and say it's a myth, it's an allegory, a lot of symbolism. But no, when you compare the text of Genesis, let's say, to some of the poetry in the book of Psalms, it's two different styles. It's rather obvious that the writer of Genesis is talking about something that really occurred. Mm-hmm. And the Hebrew language certainly strongly suggests that as well. And we're discovering in our modern scientific age that many people are not considering Christ very seriously anymore because the account of what we know happened 2,000 years or so ago is based on what's in the Bible. But if you start questioning the book of Genesis or you start questioning whether or not there was a Joshua at Jericho, then people are wondering, well, then how do we know what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote is accurate? And so if you can show people the Bible has been translated correctly over the years, that it doesn't have any historical errors in it. Well, I remember even a few years ago, people were starting to doubt whether or not there really was a King David.
Wow.
In real life. And I had the wonderful opportunity a few months ago to visit northern Israel to a place called Dan, where they found a tablet there inscribed with, you know, the house of David there. And archaeologists years ago wondered what the Bible was talking about with the sons of Heth, you know, the Hittites, as if they never really existed. Well, we've found out in the last few decades they really were the Hittites. So the more that that science looks into archaeology or science, the more it confirms what the Scripture teaches. And that's the message we want our visitors to leave with, and especially for the skeptic or the non-Christian to accept the most important biblical truth, and that is Christ coming to earth to redeem us from our sins some 2,000 years ago. So the last thing we would want is someone leaving the museum saying, okay, I've given up on evolution. But if they don't receive Christ as Savior, to us, that's been a failure in terms of their eternal destiny. Mm-hmm. And as you go through the museum, you'll see many of the biblical events displayed and recounted. Now, of course, we don't know what the Garden of Eden really looked like, so there's some guesswork involved. But there's a lot of science behind the exhibits. For example, with Adam and Eve, you notice they're kind of a middle brown in color. Mm-hmm. If Adam and Eve were middle brown, kind of a you know, Middle Eastern brown, you could explain all the different skin shades we have around the world today, from light to dark, if the original couple were middle brown. So we had to use some, you know, genetics to look at that question. And we do have a full-time geneticist on our staff with a PhD from Ohio State, Dr. Georgia Purdom. And you'll be interviewing her in the course of your visit to the Creation Museum. And we have a planetarium, which was designed by our PhD astronomer, Dr. Lyle. And we have actually
three. That was a great show, by the way.
Well, thank you. And, you know, we have three, Andy. You've seen just one.
Oh.
There's two that alternate throughout the day. And then at Christmas time, we do a special Star of Bethlehem presentation. And that's very, very evangelistic, because during the Christmas time, we get an increase in visitors, especially tourists who might, well, I would say tourists, but they're visiting family for Christmas in this area, and they come by and take a look at the museum, and then they watch the Star of Bethlehem presentation. And, you know, we've actually heard of several testimonies of people who have become Christians. Wow. As a result of touring the museum and also seeing our planetarium program.
Praise God.
And another major highlight of the museum is our special effects theater, which you're going to be seeing later today. Mm-hmm. I don't want to spoil too many of the surprises, but what goes on in that auditorium, you would have to go to Universal Studios in Florida or Disney World to get the same kind of experience. It's an experiential theater. So as you're watching what's happening on three large screens, things are happening at your seat that kind of interact with what's happening on the screen. Mm-hmm. And I'll just say the seats shake when we talk about the fountains of the great deep breaking open at the beginning of the flood. And also when we talk about the flood waters, you'll get sprayed with a little bit of water. And so those types of things happen in the special effects theater. And as you've discovered here, being on site now for a few hours, this is a very family-friendly place.
Yeah, very much.
And we want young people to come here and understand our main messages without getting into a lot of deep science, because it's the young people who are getting evolutionized, if you will, in their public schools, typically, in their science magazines, what they're watching on television. There's a lot of indoctrination we want to counter here. And it's the young people, not the adults, who are being immersed in a worldview that's totally contrary to what's presented in Scripture. So we wanted to make sure we had the animatronic dinosaurs, the fun videos throughout the museum, the special effects theater, so that the children would be engaged, that they would have fun here, but they would also learn some biblical truths.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed, too, that it very much is so much family-friendly that it makes me want to come back now. And we have one child right now who's 2.5, and I want to come back when we have a full family and they're old enough to really understand what's going on.
Well, yeah, you're discovering it's probably a bigger place than you expected. Almost everyone mm-hmm. says that. If you did everything here at the Creation Museum, including walked out on the trails to our petting zoo, if you watched every video, we have 53 short videos throughout the museum. One of the reasons being, we know that young people are not going to stand in a hallway and reading a lot of text on the walls, but they will watch a 2.5-minute video and learn about how the eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington State in 1980 helped us understand perhaps how the Grand Canyon was formed, mm-hmm. that the Grand Canyon was formed not over millions and millions of years of the Colorado River slowly carving out the northern part of Arizona, that a lot of water over a short period of time carved out the Grand Canyon. So those videos do that as well. And so as a family-friendly place, that's why we have not only the petting zoo across the lake, but if you come back next year, you'll see more child-friendly exhibits. We just got a major donation from someone a few weeks ago mm-hmm. to, for example, we're going to have an animatronic Noah. He's going to look like a real person, and children can ask him questions by pressing a button.
Oh, cool.
And Noah will speak back to the child to, for example, yes, here's how I took care of the animals on the ark, or here's where all the water came from to cover the earth. And so when you come back, you'll see many more things that'll be attractive for families.
Yeah, I look forward to that. Well, we're coming up on 12 o'clock, and I don't want to keep you, but thanks so much for the interview. And I look forward to the others.
Well, thank you, Andy. I hope you continue to enjoy your visit here today at the Creation Museum.
Is there anything you wanted to close with?
Well, I would really like to push our website, creationmuseum.org. Mm-hmm. It's a very well-done site that can help people plan their visit to the Creation Museum. We're just two exits west of the Cincinnati airport. We're very near Cincinnati, Ohio, but we're in northern Kentucky. And again, almost two-thirds of America could drive here in a day. That's one of the reasons mm-hmm. we chose this spot in all of America to build the museum, was to be close to the population centers.
And we would have done it in a day had we not had a two-and-a-half-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, Atlanta is 7 hours from here. New York City is exactly 11 hours from here. St. Louis is 6. Chicago is 5. And there are millions of Canadians, you know, in the Toronto metropolitan area who can drive here in a day as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, and I will link to your website when I post the
episode.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Andy. Enjoy your visit.
Mark mentioned in our conversation that Ken Ham was just returning from a trip to Australia and Japan. I was quite surprised to see him later on as I was finishing my tour of the museum, and he came strolling through. I introduced myself and got to chat with him for about 2 minutes or so before he needed to continue on and head home for some much-needed rest. After speaking with Mark Loy, I sat down with Dr. Terry Mortensen. Terry majored in math at the University of Minnesota before going on to earn a PhD in the history of geology at University of Coventry in England, and a Master of Divinity from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in Chicago. Terry worked for 26 years on the staff of Campus Crusade for Christ, much of that in Eastern Europe. He has also lectured on the creation-evolution controversy since the late 1970s and has spoken in homes, churches, schools, secular universities, Bible colleges, and seminaries. He has also participated in 7 formal debates with PhD evolutionary scientists in secular venues in 4 countries. Terry, thank you so much for coming in. It's great to have you here.
It's good to be with you.
So you're going to talk with us today a little bit more about the science behind the Creation Museum and the origins controversy.
Yeah, particularly in geology and the age of the earth.
Is there a particular area you like to start?
Well, I like to try to help people understand where this millions of years idea came from. Because, you know, today we think, well, everybody believes that the earth is 4.5 billion years old. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way it's always been.
So how did that then come about?
Well, of course, we know that modern science was born in Europe, and it was born in the womb of the Christian worldview. It was the Christian view of the world that led people to believe that we could study the creation and we could understand it. In fact, it was honoring to God to study the creation because he created it, and it reflects his character. And so Christianity had become the dominant force in European life, and so everybody operated within a biblical worldview, essentially, and that included creation in 6 days and about 6,000 years ago, and a global flood at the time of Noah. That was just what virtually the whole church believed the first 18 centuries. of church history. But in the late 18th and early 19th century, deists and atheists who began to study the rocks began to propose theories of the earth that postulated millions of years to form these layers that we see, for example, in the Grand Canyon, but are really everywhere under our feet.
This is right about the time of Darwin then?
Well, it was just before Darwin. In fact, it was the idea of millions of years that got embedded in science that paved the way for Darwin's theory, because Darwin just took the idea of slow, gradual change in geology and applied it to biology.
I see. Okay. Now, I did see in the museum that at one time, the pagan belief system said that the universe was eternal.
Did way back before the time of Christ, there were ancient Greek philosophers who postulated that the earth might be eternal. In fact, there were evolutionary ideas back before the time of Christ.
So I was just going to ask you if that played into...
That didn't really play into Darwin's theory. I don't think he was, and certainly the old earth theories, they weren't, if you read their writings, they weren't going back to people in the, you know, at the time of Christ or before that to develop their theories. But their theories were very similar. In fact, there was a book written by Henry Fairfield Osborne, who was the curator of the Natural History Museum, the American Natural History Museum in New York. Back in 1924, he wrote a book entitled From the Greeks to Darwin. And as he studied the ancient writings of the Greeks, he found that all the essential elements of Darwin's theory are in those writings.
Nothing new under the sun.
Nothing new under the sun.
So where do they get today their foundation for this belief system that the geological stratum is millions of years old?
Well, what set the stage for what we have today was the work of a couple of key men, James Hutton in Scotland and Charles Lyell in England. And from their writings came the idea that dominated geology for all the way up until about the 1970s, and that became known as uniformitarianism, from the word uniform. And what they contended was that all the processes of geological change that we see today, erosion, river erosion, sedimentation, wind and rain erosion, earthquakes, volcanoes, those processes have always happened in the past at the same average rate that we see happening today. And so they ruled out not only Noah's flood, but they ruled out earlier thinking of continental-wide or global catastrophic floods. And so when they looked at something like the Grand Canyon, they'd look at those layers. And in fact, the first geologically oriented explorer to go into the Grand Canyon, John Wesley Powell, back in the 1800s, he went in with this uniformitarian mentality, and so he looked at those rock layers, and he just imagined that it took millions of years to deposit those layers, and then millions of years for the Colorado River to gradually erode it away, grain of sand at a time. Hmm. And so that view has dominated geology for 200 years, and it's come into modification in the last few decades because more and more geologists are seeing evidence of catastrophic effects in the rock record, but they still believe in the millions of years.
Well, it's interesting you mention that because I was just telling Mark that we had stopped at the Field Museum in Chicago on our way down from Minneapolis, and they're very, very biased to evolution, but there was a couple little things that they presented that just caught our attention that said, you're kind of getting it. And one of them was they were talking about dinosaur fossils they found in the Gobi Desert in Mongolia, and how they had believed that the way they were deposited was that every few hundred years these big floods would come through and wipe out all the animals there and make these fossils. And my wife and I both looked at it and said, well, you're partly right.
Yeah. Catastrophe has come back into thinking in geology. But what they do is they'll say, well, they weren't global catastrophes, and each of the catastrophes were separated by millions of years. Creation scientists would say, well, you're on the right track, but there's no evidence in the geological record for the millions of years between the layers that you say were formed catastrophically. So, and we say, if you have evidence of catastrophe all over the earth, that is strong evidence of a global catastrophe, especially when you don't see the evidence of long periods of time in between the layers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pure speculation that they might say there's obviously a flood here and a flood over there and a flood over there, but to say they were separated by time and distance.
Well, I wouldn't say it's speculation. I would say they're looking at the rocks and they're seeing physical evidence in the rocks that says this wasn't formed slowly. For example, something that we find in many parts of the world are polystrate fossils. These are usually trees, and they often go through more than one layer of rock, more than one kind of rock, and often they're in a vertical or nearly vertical position. And I've got a book in my library by an old Earth evolutionary geologist, and he, before his death, he became a neo-catastrophist. He rejected the uniformitarian view largely. And he has a picture of one of these trees. Mm-hmm. And he has a little discussion of saying, well, clearly this tree couldn't have just stood there for hundreds of thousands of years waiting to be slowly buried in sediments. It would have rotted and decayed. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of clues in the rocks like this that point to catastrophe. But then because that uniformitarian thinking is still kind of a default function in the minds of most geologists, they will assume slow gradual processes or long periods of time because they've already bought the evolutionary view of the fossil record. And so, well, the fossils down in this other layer had to have been formed millions of years before because we believe in evolution. And so that's where the time comes in.
Now, you mentioned the Grand Canyon. Is it true? I've heard that this is really hard to describe through words on a podcast. It'd be easier to describe if I could draw it, but that it's said that the entrance to the canyon is higher than the bottom of the canyon, and that for the Colorado River to have carved it out, it would have had to flow uphill.
Yeah, that's not quite the way we should say it. The north rim of the Grand Canyon is 8,000 feet in elevation. The south rim is 7,000 feet. And at the northeast end of the Grand Canyon, there's what's called the Kaibab Upwarp, where the sediments have been lifted, and you can see the whole pile is bent. Okay. And so the idea that the Colorado River cut the Grand Canyon after all of that uplift would mean that the Colorado River had to go uphill to start cutting into those sediments. And rivers just don't flow uphill.
I haven't seen one.
No. So a much better view is one of two explanations that the creationists have, is that those sediments were laid down during the flood, and they were all still rather plastic, a lot of water in the sediments when the earthquake uplift occurred. And so that's why you can see rocks that are folded like or bent like a pile of pancakes slipping off the edge of a plate, still soft. And then that either in the recessional stage of the flood, the canyon was carved, or shortly after the flood ended, as waters were trapped in what there appears to be some geological evidence of some two very large lakes to the northeast of the Grand Canyon, that waters were trapped there. And then as the Green River and the Colorado River drainage systems continued to bring lots of water into those lakes, they eventually breached the top of that natural dam. Mm. And those lakes drained and carved the canyon through relatively soft sediments in a very short period of time.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah. A lot of questions we still need to answer, but that seems a lot more reasonable than the evolutionary story.
What are some other examples in geology that we can look at to say that the millions of years just doesn't add up?
Well, one of the things is the fossils themselves. The fossils, you can't really – you have to have very unusual conditions to produce a fossil slowly. Fossils speak of rapid burial and rapid deposition and rapid fossilization because, for example, we used to have – thousands, maybe millions of bison on the prairie states of the United States. And white men came through there and just slaughtered them because they were in the way of farming or building the railroad or whatever. And there's no fossil evidence that they ever existed. Why? Because their dead carcasses were not buried. And so scavengers and then micro-decay organisms, and then once the bones, any of those left, the wind and the sun and the rain beating on them, it's all gone. So the fact that we find fossils speaks of rapid burial and fossilization. And many times it speaks very eloquently. A lot of times we find not only fish skeletons, but the soft parts of fish. And fish decay very rapidly in days. We find, you know, some of the fossils we find that make the big news are dinosaur fossils. And sometimes an enormous part of their bodies is fossilized. Well, you don't bury a huge dinosaur, you know, an eighth of an inch a year, mm-hmm. and have it fossilized. It's going to be destroyed by decay processes. So the fossils record speaks of catastrophic processes.
Do we also find, is it still the case that we find some circular reasoning, too, where a paleontologist will date a fossil based on the rock layer it's in, but then the rock layer will be dated based on the fossil that it contains,
sort of is that way. What they use is index fossils. There are certain fossils that they consider to be characteristic of certain periods of history, and those then date a rock layer. And then when they find other fossils in that rock layer, well, then they say, well, that's how old that fossil is. But the question, it begs the question, how do they know how old the index fossils are? Mm-hmm. Well, they're assuming an evolutionary history. There's another key assumption in geology that is absolutely critical to the old Earth view, and that is that the absence of a creature in a particular rock layer means that the creature didn't exist at the time that layer was deposited. So it's the absence of evidence is evidence of absence argument. Mm-hmm. But there are many, many fossils that prove that that is false, and they're called living fossils. They're creatures that evolutionists thought had gone extinct millions of years ago, and then they found them alive today, and when they compare the living creature with the fossil, it's virtually indistinguishable. And yet all of those rock layers between the highest layer where we found the fossil and our modern world, there are no fossils of the creature, but none of the evolutionists believe those creatures evolved into existence the day before they were discovered or the year before. So we have the Wallamai pine tree in Australia, thought to have gone extinct 150 million years ago, found living in Australia in 1994. Or the coelacanth fish, thought to have gone extinct 65 million years ago with the dinosaurs, because that was the highest rock layer that we found these fish, and they were found living off the seacoast in 400 feet of water off the coast of Madagascar. And so there are lots, hundreds of these living fossils. And that just shows that the absence of a creature in a rock layer doesn't prove that it didn't exist. But mm-hmm. that whole argument was key in the 19th century to men saying, well, the whole rock record was formed before Adam and Eve were created because we don't find people down in those rock layers. It's a fallacious argument, mm-hmm. fallacious assumption. I think what we need to understand in this whole argument is the critical role of philosophical assumptions. When the men in the 19th century developed the ideas of millions of years, whether it was millions of years of slow, gradual change, or the idea before that of every so often a global or continental scale flood wiping out most or all of the creatures, and then life went along for millions of years, and then there was another major flood, and in between, God supernaturally created new creatures to replace what had died out, or survivors, you know, repopulated the earth. Both of those ideas came out of making unreasonable, unproven, and really anti-biblical philosophical assumptions. Now, Charles Lyell didn't observe all of past history to know that the geological processes going on today have always gone on at the same rate and power and frequency. He just assumed that. And I document in my book, The Great Turning Point, which was published back in 2004 and is based on my PhD work, I document from Lyell's writings that he had a consciously anti-biblical agenda in what he was doing in geology. So these people were not unbiased pursuers of truth. In fact, there is no such scientist. Every scientist has a worldview. He has a certain set of assumptions that affect what kinds of questions he's going to ask when he goes out and looks at, say, the rock layers, what kinds of answers he's going to allow in his mind as an explanation for what he sees. And so to think that a geologist goes out to the Grand Canyon and he just looks at the rocks and the rocks speak of millions of years is a completely erroneous way of looking at what geologists or any other scientist does. And so the evolutionist is just as biased against the Bible as any creationist is for the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the question is, well, are the assumptions that they're operating with sound? And the only way to answer that is using theological and philosophical arguments. You can't use rocks and fossils to determine whether the uniformitarian assumption is true or not. That's an assumption about the unobserved past.
Mm-hmm.
And the rocks right in front of you at the Grand Canyon aren't going to tell you whether that assumption is right. So then it becomes a battle at the level of worldviews. Does that make sense?
It does. I do very much appreciate that creationism in general and then answers in Genesis in specific, that there's far more, it just comes across to me as being far more honest. That, like you're saying, you're talking about your bias and their bias, but you don't necessarily let your bias cloud the evidence, whereas an evolutionist seems to be dedicated to clouding.
If we're not aware of our assumptions, they will distort our thinking. The best way to really be fair with the evidence is to be aware of your assumptions and to be honest about them.
Mm-hmm.
And most evolutionists are not honest about their assumptions. And they try to give us the impression that they're just letting the facts speak for themselves.
Right. And you're not quite as bothered when you encounter something that is hard to explain.
Yeah, we know we don't have all the answers. There's lots of research that still needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But when we start with the scriptures as a historical record from the Creator, and we have good reasons to believe that that's what it is, and we go out and look at the world, it makes sense of the world, and it guides the kinds of questions that we ask to, you know, getting back to the Grand Canyon. John Wesley Powell, when he went into the canyon in the 1860s, I think it was, he wasn't thinking, you know, I wonder if there's any evidence here that would be consistent with a global year-long flood as described in the Bible. It wasn't even on the radar, although he grew up in a Bible-believing Methodist home. But he rejected what he had been taught, and he embraced Darwinism at a young age, at the age of 20 or something, and that became the ruling paradigm in his thinking.
Well, I don't want to keep you too long. I thank so much for coming in, and it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, good to talk to you, Andy.
And
hope this will stimulate some thinking with your podcast listeners.
Yeah, and I'll have to get more information on your book so I can maybe link to that too, and if people are interested in it.
Yeah. Another book that just came out that I would mention is dealing with the whole biblical side. It's called Coming to Grips with Genesis, and 14 theologians contributed to that book to defend young earth creationism biblically, theologically, and historically. So we're not dealing with the science, but it's a really much needed book, just came out at the end of last year. Because as Christians, we have to deal with both the scientific side of the argument and the biblical side.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no way to fit millions of years in evolution into the Bible
mm-hmm.
if we're really careful with the biblical text.
All right, well, I'll look for that one. It sounds like a good one. So thanks again.
All right.
My third and final interview while at Answers in Genesis was with Dr. Georgia Purdom. Georgia received her PhD in molecular genetics from Ohio State University in 2000 and has since then developed into an expert on the growing creation-evolution controversy. She is a writer, lecturer, teacher, and all-around jack-of-all-trades at AIG, helping out wherever needed. She especially enjoys speaking to women's groups and is dedicated to stressing the importance of biblical creationism as foundational to biblical authority, and the Christian Worldview. So, Georgia, thank you for being here. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
No problem. Glad to be here.
So you are a biologist on staff here at Answers in Genesis?
Correct, yes. My degree is in molecular genetics, but that's under the area of biology. So I'm one of the people that helps out in anything that we have related to biology.
Okay. And you were just telling me you have some other roles here too as well.
Yes, I'm a writer, so I write for a magazine and our website, and then I also do research. So I mainly do research in the area of microbiology, looking at bacteria and specifically the genetics of bacteria, understanding mutation and natural selection and the roles that they play and don't play, so to speak, in dealing with microbes and those kinds of things. And then I also speak. I do speaking engagements here at the museum as well at other venues in the U.S. and Canada. And so they keep me plenty busy, that's for sure.
I really am eager to jump into some of the meat here. What can you tell us about looking at biology from a creationist, a biblical worldview, and some of the myths that people might believe about what you believe that you don't believe, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, it does. I think one of the things I focus on a lot is mutation and natural selection, because those are things that you hear a lot about in the news. You hear a lot about it in a lot of venues by evolutionists that supposedly support evolution, that those are the mechanisms. You know, these random changes over time have been selected for, and that has allowed, you know, some sort of single-celled organism to eventually evolve into a human being. That's the basic, you know, concept of it. And the problem with that, firstly, is that mutation doesn't build things. It tears things down. It degenerates. And so far, we've never seen an example of a mutation which adds information to our DNA, which gives us more, gives any organism more. It takes away from what's already there. And so that's a real problem for evolution, because if you're going to go from a single-celled organism to a human being, you have to add information. Okay, you can't just like tweak it, so to speak, and get a human. It doesn't work that way. You've got to make changes. And so the problem is the changes that we see being made are degenerative. They don't add to it. They take away from it. So that's one problem. And then there's the problem of natural selection. There's no doubt that natural selection works. I mean, we see it happening in populations of organisms today. So they will have certain characteristics that are favored. So, for example, a mouse that has light-colored fur might do really well on a sandy beach somewhere, okay? But you put it in a forest where it's really dark, okay, and green, not going to do as well. You know, it's going to be caught by the predators a lot more easily. Mm-hmm. And so those kinds of things is what natural selection can accomplish. You know, it can favor certain colored hair or certain, you know, those types of characteristics, because it can see them, so to speak. It's obvious, and it can do that. But what it does is it tends to make an organism or a population of organisms more specialized for their environment, such as you get all sandy-colored mice, you know, on a sandy beach, and in the forest you get all dark-colored mice, you know, in a forest. It tends to take away the variety and the selection and just end up with an organism that's very well suited for its environment. So again, that's a problem for evolution, because the idea with evolution is that natural selection somehow is going to select and give you more variety, basically, so that you go from just one organism, a single-celled organism, up to all the different organisms that we have today. So it's really a problem on both counts. In both counts, you're taking away, you're degenerating, so to speak, you're taking away variety, you're taking away information, you're not adding to it, which is what a requirement of sort of what we call molecules to man up evolution requires. So I like to focus on that, and I like to point that out to people, because you see it all the time in the media. Oh, well, you know, this is an example of evolution in action. I mean, how many times have you heard that, you know, especially when I talk a lot about antibiotic-resistant bacteria. You know, that's a huge one in our society today. And again, it's not an example of evolution in action. If you mean evolution as in change, yeah, they're changing. But that's not evolution. That's not the way that they really mean it. They're talking about it in, oh, these are the kind of changes that eventually lead to a microbe, you know, a bacteria bacteria becoming a man, but it doesn't. They're just mm-hmm. small-scale changes that allow the bacteria to vary within its environment, but that's it. It's not going to lead to these big-scale changes that they talk about.
Well, since you bring it up, how do you deal with that when you hear about, like right now we're talking about swine flu in the news,
mm-hmm.
And they're talking about all the mutations they're worried about and stuff. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with the arguments and the evidence that you see in bacteria like
well,
that?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's most powerful to me is just to get the information out there to people. And that's why I like mm-hmm. to write and talk to people about these issues. We get calls from various journalists on what is our opinion, you know, on this particular, you know, issue. So I like to do that to get the word out that in explaining to people that a lot of what you see is what we call equivocation. So they're saying, they mean, well, look, this is evolution in action. Now, they know that what they're seeing is small-scale changes. They know that. Mm-hmm. But they're equivocating it. You know, in most people's minds, evolution is going from, you know, some sort of monkey to man. I mean, that's evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is they're using it one way, but everybody else is thinking something else, and even they're thinking that. You know, but they're trying to almost, they're switching the term, so to speak, on us. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. And so I think it's about getting, and we have a natural selection exhibit here at the museum that I helped design because I thought it was really important for people to understand that when you hear about evolution in action, look really closely. What are they really observing? You know, oh, they're observing a change in the size of the finch beak, or they're observing a change in the color of the hair, or they're observing, you know, nothing. No new appendages, no new structures, you know, nothing like that. It's not becoming something else. It's just some variation within that population. So that's mm-hmm. That's what people need to really evaluate and look closely at.
And in the museum, I didn't get through the whole thing. I was telling Mark, but one thing I did see that was very nice was this emphasis that things represent or reproduce after their own kind.
Mm-hmm.
And that we don't need to have, like Noah's Ark, for instance, wouldn't have needed to have a wolf and a dog and a coyote.
Right.
And it
right.
would just need a
mm-hmm.
couple dogs.
Yeah, we talk about the biblical word kind, and we use that term a lot here, and that comes from the Bible, so that's why we use that term. But what it means in common everyday language here, like what does that refer to? Well, like you were saying, it doesn't refer to like every single type of dog that's out there, from a bloodhound to a dachshund to, you know, that's mm-hmm. not kind. Those are species. Well, they're not even species.
They're breeds.
When yeah. you're talking about dogs, it's actually breeds because they're all the same species. But in the classification scheme, you typically go from, you know, very large groups of organisms to smaller. So you go kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. So and what we're talking about when we talk about kind is probably at the family level. So not at the genus and not at the species, but at the family level. And there's a lot of creation scientists that actually study that and look at that and try to determine what of the animals we have today, what is part of the original kind, you know, like the horse kind, the dog kind, you know, whatever it might be, trying to classify organisms because they've varied a lot since the flood. And so sometimes it's hard. I mean, you look at things like a platypus and you think, okay, where does that go? There may be a platypus kind, you know, some organisms are very, very unique, so to speak. But everybody knows, even a child. I mean, I have a 5-year-old daughter, and I mean, she can tell me by looking at a wolf, a coyote, a dingo, a jackal, you know, a dog, she knows that those are all one category of animal. You know, mm-hmm. it's almost like a natural, you know, something God has almost put within us, you know, to naturally recognize, oh yeah, you know, that's one kind of animal. So Noah didn't have to take that many animals on the ark because he didn't have to take every breed of dog. He didn't have to take every species or even genus, just every, mm-hmm. just two of every kind and seven of some. So that made it a lot better.
One thing I was kind of surprised about was I was walking through and it talked about in Genesis when Adam was naming the animals.
Mm-hmm.
It said that there actually were, because of the kinds, was probably only around 200 different animals that he mm-hmm. had to name.
Yeah, and he didn't have to name every kind of animal. He didn't name the fish. He didn't name, you're testing my knowledge here, trying to remember he didn't have to name every type of animal. He didn't name the wild animals. He named mm-hmm. mainly those that were going to be more probably closely associated with man, versus every single animal that was out there. So yeah, he didn't have to name, and he was only naming kinds. I mean, they hadn't, speciated out from that, you know, and gotten all the different, you know, he named a wolf, maybe, you know, or whatever he named it, but not, you know, a bloodhound, a dachshund, you know, not all of those. So it's very plausible to name those, you know, in a very short period of time. And a lot of people have issues with that. You know, they say, Adam couldn't have named, you know, all those animals in less than a day. Well, yeah, he could have if we understand what the Bible tells us he named and we understand the category of kind.
Mm-hmm. Now, I also wanted to mention, I had mentioned to Mark and to Terry that on the way down from Minneapolis, we stopped in Chicago. And while there, I went to the Field Museum, which obviously has a very evolutionist bias from it. One thing I thought was interesting was they had a little display talking about asexual reproduction and sexual reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought you might enjoy this.
Okay, I'm sure I will.
Because I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, okay, but how did we get from asexual to sexual? Mm-hmm. Did all of a sudden a male and a female happen to evolve out of that asexual reproduction at the same time, at the same place?
That is a huge problem for evolution, is how do you get sexual reproduction? Because like you say, I mean, especially when you look at some of the ways in which organisms reproduce and their reproductive structures, they're very complex. I mean, these are not simple structures. Mm-hmm. And so how, you know, you have to have them evolve at the same time or nothing's going
to
happen.
And they have
to
find each other too. You can't have a male over here and a female way over there.
Exactly.
Especially when you're talking about single cell organisms.
Mm-hmm. And they have to figure out what to do, you know, and why this is important to do. And the other thing, too, with that is it's really a problem for them when it comes to natural selection, because why would these reproductive organs be selected for if there was no benefit to them? You know, it would be hard to build them up, so to speak, over time if there was no immediate benefit, you know, and there was... It's not something natural selection, quote unquote, sees. You know, how is that really benefiting the organism if they have these organs, reproductive organs, but they don't have a mate? I mean, you know, it's not like it can say, "Oh, I'll save it until, you know, I do get a mate." It's not going to happen that way. You know, evolution doesn't work like that, and so it becomes a real problem for them.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the other problems that you address? Or
boy, there's so many.
Where do you start?
It's where to start. You know, I think
this is what I enjoy when I come in and when I read articles by Answers in Genesis or similar ministries or organizations. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I enjoy the most is that we can explain things that evolutionists can't. And so that's why I asked the question.
Yeah. And they really have to. I think one of my favorite things is, I mean, it's just kind of biology, but kind of outside of biology, too, is dealing with soft tissue and dinosaur bones. That's probably one of my favorite examples of something that's really difficult to explain from an evolutionary perspective of millions of years, because several years ago now, and there's been more and more research coming out about this, they found that they were finding this soft tissue, like blood vessels, red blood cells, inside of dinosaur bones. And the scientist that's done probably the most work on it is Mary Schweitzer. And she is actually a video out now of her taking a piece of the bone that she's demineralized, because that's how you do this to investigate this. And she's actually bending it. And it's supposed to be 65 million years old. And that's a serious problem for them, because a lot of research has been done to figure out, you know, how long should molecules last, like DNA, proteins, things like that. Mm-hmm. And estimates are maybe at the most a couple hundred thousand years. And you're talking this thing is 65 million years old. Mm-hmm. So it's a clear controversy for them. And there's been some people recently who have tried to explain it away, saying, well, it's not really what it appears. It's really caused by bacteria. And, you know, and that hasn't really held a lot of water, so to speak, because she's done even more research to show that's really not the case, and these really are legitimate things we're seeing. You know, there's legitimate bone proteins there. We shouldn't be seeing these, but we are. And so you would think, so obviously they would say, you would think, well, maybe they would say, well, we're wrong. You know, it's really not millions of years old. That's really only a couple thousand years old. Because if it's from the flood, which it most likely is, it's only 4,500 years old at the most. And so, but what they would say is, and it just goes to show you, it's really about worldviews. It's really about starting points. They'll say, well, there's a process of fossilization that occurs that we just don't understand. And it's like, okay, you know, and that's called a rescuing device. You know, they're trying to rescue their worldview and not give it up. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Mary Schweitzer actually had a lot of problems getting her work published because no one believed her.
Well, what is her worldview? Is she Is she a creationist?
She's an evolutionist. No, she's an evolutionist, and she would say that there's just some process of fossilization that occurs that we just don't have a grasp on yet, because they're not going to give up that worldview. Probably, they want to hold to that. They're so sure of that, quote unquote. And I think for me, you know, looking at something like that where the evidence is so blatantly obvious. It just goes to show you that it's a matter of worldviews, and it's a matter of starting points. Do we start with our own ideas about the past, or do we start with God's ideas about the past? And so, I think for me, that's one of my favorite examples, or one of the things I like to use in a lot of my presentations.
Well, it sounds like a Richard Dawkins Science of the Gaps kind of explanation too.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's so interesting because a lot of these people are realizing how complex even the simplest cells are. I mean, we talk about bacteria and people say, oh, those had to be the first organisms, you know, on Earth. And it's like, bacteria are very, very complex. I mean, they're not simple. They might be simple compared to us, but you know, simple is kind of a relative term. They have very complex mechanisms to do what they do. And it's interesting because what you're seeing more and more of is people trying to push the beginnings of life into outer space, okay? Mm-hmm. So rather than being here on Earth, they say, you know, and the reason they're doing that, right, is because things are so complex. And they say, well, there hasn't been enough time. Earth has only been around 4.5 billion years, okay, according to them. That's not enough time for things to have evolved, or even life to have started, you know, because even simple life is not so simple. And so how do you do this? Well, you push it into outer space, because the rest of outer space is older, you know, up to 15 billion years. Mm-hmm. So it gives more time. And then you've got people like Dawkins and some others even, and Dawkins said this and Expelled, you know, that maybe there's some intelligent life out there that has that has sent life to Earth, you know, seeded life on Earth, basically. And you're like, you know, and when he said that, and it was a lot of people have talked about that, because it was like, I can't believe he just said that, you know, kind of thing. But it's an actual theory. It's called directed panspermia. It has an actual name. And Crick, who was one of the discoverers of the structure of DNA, he was the first one to sort of coin the term back in the 70s. And he's got a whole paper. I just read it recently for a chapter I was writing, a book chapter, on the spaceship, what it might have contained, its payload, how they could have transported things to Earth. And this was published in it wasn't necessarily published in like a scientific journal, but it was also very like, this is something that could have happened, because if life on Earth has evolved and it's only been around 4.5 billion years, then certainly if the rest of the universe is older than that, then certainly intelligent life has evolved in other places and it's been able to send life here to Earth. And it's just amazing. I mean, and you read this stuff and you think, how can they get this in scientific journals, you know, and actually think this is a scientific viewpoint. But it's because they're faced with the awesome complexity of the cell.
And then point at you simultaneously and say, well, you're basing everything you do on faith, on blind faith.
Theirs is a blind faith. Ours is a reasoned faith. You know, that's really the difference. Because a lot of people think, oh, Christians have a blind faith. No, we don't. Mm-hmm. We have a reasoned faith, a reasonable faith. We start with Scripture as our starting point, and what we see out there in the world confirms it. It's a reasoned faith. Now, if nothing out there, you know, looked anything like what Scripture talks about or wouldn't confirm it, then we'd be like, that would be a blind faith. But it does. And that's the difference for them, is that theirs is a blind faith. There's no, absolutely any evidence of extraterrestrial life, intelligent or not intelligent, okay? But yet, you know, they're willing to believe that before they believe in God. It's because they don't want to be responsible, you know, to God. Because if there is God, then they realize they have... they're going to have to change their lives, and many people don't want to.
Well, we're coming up with just a few minutes left, and I'd like to just let you close. Is there anything you want to mention before we go?
It was kind of interesting. I just recently had my daughter just recently started school, and so I've been thinking a lot about the roles of parents, and I just want to encourage anyone out there that's thinking of becoming a parent or is a parent to really realize that is your role to teach your children. I'm not saying you have to homeschool, but I'm saying that it is your role in the home to teach your child the truths of Scripture. And we need to be doing that as parents, as grandparents, aunts, uncles, whatever. It is ultimately our responsibility to do that. And that's something that, I don't know, I guess I've started to realize a lot more with having a child in school and thinking about that. And realizing that a lot of kids are walking away from the church, no matter whether they've been homeschooled, Christian schooled, or public schooled. And that what that shows us is it really does matter what mom and dad say, and how important that is to become educated on these issues and teach your kids not only to know God's word, but to be able to defend it in the world that we live in today. Because those are the things they're going to be faced with. And if they don't have answers for people, then their faith is going to be challenged. And we don't want that. We want their faith to be firm. And it can be if we do our responsibility and our role in raising our children.
Well said. Thank you so
much. Thank you.
And thanks so much for coming in. It was short, but it was very enjoyable.
Oh, no problem. I enjoy it. Thank you.
Yeah. After speaking with Mark, Terry, and Georgia, I ate a late lunch and then returned to the museum to pick up where I had left off when Mark came and found me. I was quite surprised at how rich it was. I had been in there for well over an hour before heading to do the interviews, but didn't realize I hadn't gone very far, and was able to get back to where I had left off pretty quickly. The exhibits at the museum were very interesting, especially for someone who loves to soak in whatever I can in regards to young Earth creationism. As I mentioned in the interviews, they are very fair to the evolutionary worldview, and are not afraid to acknowledge it right next to the explanations of their own biblical worldview. The museum is a great place to visit, and as I mentioned in my conversation with Mark, I really look forward to returning at some point in the future when my kids are old enough to really understand what is being presented there. So I'd really recommend, if you're in the Cincinnati area or planning a road trip through that part of the country, take some time and stop in and see the Creation Museum. It really is worth the time. So a big hearty thank you to the folks at Answers in Genesis, to Mark Loy, Terry Mortensen, and Georgia Purdom, for having me and for taking the time to speak with me. It was a lot of fun. And thank you for joining me for another enjoyable episode. I look forward to the next one, and I'll be back again in October.